Good afternoon. My name is Jenny Hall. The date today is the 24th of April 2023. We're presently situated in Havelock North, and my guest today is Hugh Thornton. He has offered to talk about the life and times of his family.
Good afternoon. I'm Hugh, and this is my story, or part of my story. My story goes right back to my great-grandfather, Robert Henry Head, who was being sent out of the Royal Navy for refusing to order a flogging on one of his men on his ship. He was decommissioned and he then shipped himself out of Britain to the goldfields of Australia. And while he was in the Australian goldfields, gold was discovered in New Zealand. Gabriel Scuddy and Otago, he came across to try his luck. But the winter was so cold that he went back to Australia, and once again he had the call of the sea, and he decided to sign up on the crew of the brand new vessel belonging to the London Missionary Society. This was the John Williams II.
Do you know what year that was?
Yes, in 1867. The John Williams II was built in Aberdeen from funds raised by school children of New South Wales and Victoria. And he was on the maiden voyage of the John Williams II up into the Pacific Islands, where she became wrecked on Nui Island. She had been standing offshore for a couple of days with a very strong current come up and pushed her onto the cliffs. The sea was dead calm, and they could not raise sail to get offshore, and the current too strong for the ship to be towed out with two of their boats. And the current caused huge seas to crash on the island, and the ship broke up at the foot of the cliffs that night. All hands aboard were saved, and later taken to Samoa by Bully Hayes, aboard his ship, the Rona. Robert Henry Head did not leave Niue, but he stayed there for 54 years as a trader. He was a young man and found a lady, the daughter of one of the village chiefs. This was an arranged marriage by the missionary of the islands, George Laws, to keep it correct in eyes of the church. This couple are my great-grandparents, Robert and Pelanisi Head. They went on to have 15 children. Wow. My grandmother, Frances, was number 12.
Do you know the maiden name of the girl he married?
Yes, Pelanisi.
What was her Christian name?
I can come back to that one later.
Was that her Christian name?
Pelanisi was the surname. Robert and Pelanisi. Maybe it wasn't. But we've been there ourselves to walk the path. We've all been over. 32 of us. And they went on to have 15 children. Frances arrived in Auckland, New Zealand, from Nui on the barge Jezebel on Christmas Day 1894. She was 10 years old and spoke no English. She lived in Epsom in a home her father had owned for his children to get education. Frances went on to the Epsom Girls Grammar School.
She came over with family, or she came over on her own?
She came over on her own. It was connected to family. They had their own big house in Epsom. There was family here.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, back in Kidderminster, England, my other great-grandparents, Henry and Jane Barnes, were raising a family of nine and becoming disillusioned with what was happening in England and decided that they'd immigrate to New Zealand. So they sent out their eldest son, Thomas, to check out the country and report back. On receiving a good report, they sold everything in Kidderminster and shipped out to New Zealand on the Arawa, arriving in Wellington in 1888. The younger children went to school at the Terrace School, and the older ones became confectioners, painters, ironmongers and accountants. My grandfather, Joseph Glenham Barnes, was the second youngest of the children and became an architect and builder. On arriving in Wellington, they lived in Austin Street, number 64. My grandfather married twice, with the daughter of his first marriage, but was separated not long after the daughter was born. I can tell you why he got divorced. He came home and found his wife in bed with his lawyer. But the divorce didn't happen until 1914. But he had met my grandmother, Frances Head, about 1907, and they lived together and got married in 1915 in Gisborne. They built a home together in Gisborne and had four children. The eldest was my mother, Margaret Josephine Barnes. And at the same time in Grimsby, England, at number 8 Pelham Street, lived my paternal grandparents, James Fowles Thornton and his wife, Jane Elizabeth, at East Southern. They had four sons, of which my father, William Thomas Thornton, was number 3. His father, James Fowles Thornton, was an engineer on the fishing trawler Rosedale and was killed when the ship was mined in the North Sea and sank with all hands. This happened on October 16, 1915, and his wife, Elizabeth Jane Thornton, died of cancer 9 years later, leaving four orphan boys, the eldest being 16. And there is a plaque in one of the parks in London, which we saw when we were over there, that has my grandfather's recognition.
So he's not buried there?
No, no. No, they never found his body. He's flown up on the ship. Percy, the eldest, had already gone to sea and did not know of his mother's death until he arrived home from his first voyage to find another family living in what had been his home when he left. His three brothers had been sent to Newlands, a home for the orphan children of British seamen in Hull. It was from here that the three brothers in the orphanage came to New Zealand. Each one came to New Zealand as they turned 15 under a scheme for a trust run by the New Zealand sheep owners and acknowledgement of debt to British seamen. All the boys and girls that came to New Zealand under the scheme were orphans. They came to Flockhouse at Bulls in the Manawatū and were given 6 months' farm training before being sent out on different farms around the North Island. The trust looked after their charges very well and made follow-up visits to check out on their welfare and made sure that they weren't exploited. Bill Thornton arrived in Wellington on the SS Rotorua in 1927. My father, William Thomas Thornton, 10 years later, was working at the Ruakaturi Valley when he met my grandfather, Joseph Glenham Barnes, who was in the valley building a homestead for the Smith family. He got a ride with him to Gisborne and was invited to stay with the Barneses for a short time. My mother, Margaret Barnes, met him for the first time as they came out of the bathroom, and as she told this short story, she thought, "He's mine." The rest is history. They got married and had 8 children, 7 sons and 1 daughter. I am the second child of Bill and Peggy Thornton.
We get to follow on with you.
When Mum and Dad got married, they lived at Ruakaturi for a while. Then Dad, would you believe, was the chauffeur for Turi House station owner, one of the Williamses, I can't think of his name. He was the chauffeur that drove around in the car. But Mum got pregnant with her first boy, Albert, and when they found out she was pregnant, no babies allowed. So Dad had to find another job. And I think from there he went to live in Cook Street, then he moved on from Cook Street and lived in Tarahuru in a 2-bedroomed, almost country cottage owned by a dairy farmer down the road. It had, I think, 2 bedrooms and a room outside, and between them was a dirt floor, and Mum had to keep it oiled to keep the dust down. We're going back to 1943, 44, 45. Mm-hmm. And at the bottom of where we lived, down at the bottom of the hill, was the Tarahuru River. We always liked to tell the story of my eldest brother and I. We'd gone down to have a look at the river, and we were only 4 and 5. We cheekily walked out, and there was low tide, to the water's edge. And we backpedaled and put our feet in our footmarks so that it looked like we'd just gone into the water. And my mum came down, and she couldn't find us, but she saw the footprints. And the next thing we heard, the wailing and the gnashing and the crying, and we were hiding behind an old willow tree. We jumped out, and we weren't very popular. But then we lived there until 1951, when I went to Mangapapa school from day one until standard 3. Granddad passed away and Mum and Dad bought the 10-acre farm. But in those days, Granddad, being a very staunch Englishman, still carried on the tradition of the farm going to the eldest son. But he'd come back from the war, my Uncle Henry, and had already built a new house, and etc., in Oates Street in Gisborne. His son is still living in it today. So Mum and Dad, they had no money, but Dad's brother offered them £500 as a deposit for the house. They paid £2,500 for it and the 10 acres. There was condition to the fact of the £500 that Dad had borrowed off his brother. Another brother of Dad's had come out on the third draft to Flockhouse, and he got injured when he was 15, kicked by a horse, and he thought he was fine, but the injury started to calcify his bones, and within the matter of 2 or 3 years, his body was just one slab of calcium. But the Flockhouse were very, very good to them. They sent him back to England for operations prior to the Second World War, and he was actually in one of the hospitals in London that were being bombed. But he could only move his arms, open his jaw, arms, jaw, and he couldn't turn his head even. Now, the condition of the £500 was that we had to take him as a lodger. And I remember the day that he arrived in a big Buick, a 1936 Buick, and he was laying fully stretched out in the car, and we were all out in the country, country bumpkins as it were, looking at this guy that was arriving and how they pulled him out of the car, and we'd had a room all set for him. But he got around by walking on trestles. He had his arms on the other side of the trestle. He'd move his body forward on a swing, and then he'd move the trestles forward, a zigzag like that, and that's how he got around.
A trestle like a trestle table?
No, no. And the trestles actually were made on his return back from England in 1947 by one of the ship's carpenters. And they today are still with my brother in Wellington.
So no walking frames in those days.
No walking frames, but they were ideal for what he had. He was very fortunate in many ways because he came to live with us in 52. He died in 1973, I think. But it was our job from the eldest right through. Mum and Dad had seven children that survived. Mum had four under five from 1940 to 1945. And then she had a big lapse and had another four from the 1950s. Same Dad. It was just the way it was in those days. Yeah. Uncle Ted came to live with us, and it was our job to get him up in the morning and to put him to bed and do anything that he wanted. To get him out of bed, he's laying prostrate on the bed. We would then grab his feet and pull them around to the edge of the bed, and then we would pull him to the edge of the bed and pull his body over so that he was almost balanced. We'd put a trestle on either side, flip his body up, and away he went.
So he could still
He could roll his eyes, but he couldn't move his head. He could open his jaw and move his arms. But he had a great disposition. I think it taught us compassion, because we all did it as we got older. One left home, the next one would move and sort of be the one that was there. And I can remember taking him out on friends, 1947, probably the first ute that was ever around. It was a Vauxhall converted into a ute. And I put a mattress on the back of the thing, and we did exactly what we did, pushed him back, pulled him into the thing. We drove him into town, pulled the mattress out and put his stretcher down, and we walked down. And I was totally uninhibited.
So where did you go to high school?
No, I was at Mangapapa Primary, and then we went to Macquarie School for 3 years. Yeah. And Macquarie School had the best influence over me. The teacher that was there, his name was Alfred Bullock, and he was a wonderful teacher. I think he ended up being there probably for 40-something years. It was the country school closest to Gisborne, but he taught us things that just, you know, made life so much easier. We had to go for our manual training once a week to Tikaraka, which was 20 miles away. And this is where the story really starts. On the way to Tikaraka, just prior to crossing over the Waipoua River, but looking over the river on your left, was the old Waipoua freezing works. Now, my granddad, James Glenham Barnes, was the carpenter for W.D. Leisner, who was the MP for Gisborne at that stage. I think about 1914, they were trying to get a freezing works operating, and it had to be built. And my grandfather had a lot of concrete experience, and W.D. Leisner used him, and he was one of the foremen that was the construction engineer for the building. But it sat there empty. Unfortunately, it only lasted, I think, in production probably for 9 years, and then it went broke because of one of the other firms. And then that's when Nelson Brothers, who owned Timona Freezing Works in Hastings, came in and bought it. Now, that work sat there from 1929, and it's still there today. Once a week, we go back and I look at this, looking over them, just thinking of my grandfather and et cetera, and how it could be utilised. But it's just remained a memory in my mind. Thinking back with Mr. Bullen, the fortunate things that I was lucky about, and I didn't know this at the time, I was the teacher's wife's pet. She lived in the country schoolhouse. Yeah, yeah. She didn't work, but I was one that always had to take the message. It never ever clicked to me until I was told some years later. But he was what I would call a man of wisdom. As well, his teaching ability was so good. Once every day after 2 o'clock playtime, we had to write a diary, and he would give us a topic. Two sentences, a verb, an adjective, and a noun. And he would then mark them, etc. The easiest one to do was how he taught us the weather. We'd go out and he'd run us through the weather, and then we could go in and write the weather, the clouds and the cumulus, and then miss the weather, the winds were going, etc., etc. And that's how we learnt the structure of the clouds. Going back to his wisdom, on a Friday afternoon, the girls used to do sewing. The boys had to do gardening. And we were doing the gardening around the swimming pool. The power pole that went into the school was planted in the grounds of where the swimming pool was, but it had started to loosen the soil around. It was very loose. And silly me, I grabbed hold of it and I shook it. And I could see that, jeepers, this is loose. So I gave it another big shake. Next thing, the wires are starting to swing like this, and I'm thinking, well, I'm in trouble here. And they met, and there was a big spark, a big flash. The school went into darkness, and I thought I was for the high jump. And nothing happened. Nothing happened. And I was quite prepared to take whatever was, but no one was called out. The school had to all go home. Girls had to go home. But 20 years later, when he retired, he went up to my mum and told her the story. And this is where I say a man of wisdom. He said, he turned around and said to my mum, he saw it all. But he said, my reaction afterwards was enough punishment.
Yeah.
That was Mr. Bullen. Yeah. He was a great old guy.
I think children who go to country schools always get up to some sort of mischief.
Of course you do. Of course you do. But he controlled everything. If you went to school and your road was that way, there was no way that you were going to go home the other way. Yeah. And he had everybody totally in control. But this was the way it was. It was good.
Did you go to high school?
Yes. Prior to that, though, when we were at high school, I was helping the neighbours milk cows, and as brothers we took it in turns to do milking of probably about herds of 60, I think they were. Bill Cahill, who was one of the rangatira of the local Maori there. Yes, I went to high school, boys high, and I took the agricultural class. I wanted to be a farmer. And then 2.5 years into high school, I remember coming home and Mum and Dad saying, look, you want to leave school? I said, yes. We've just been approached by a guy and he's broken his leg in 8 places, but he needs someone to milk the cows. And there was only a small herd. And that was a guy by the name of Eric Hart. And so I left school and I'd had a wee bit of farming practice and wasn't, so it was difficult not to get in. It was only a small herd. And that was my first experience with farming as a career. I worked for him for 5 years. In the off-season, his best mate, Les Jakes, was one of the major agricultural contractors in Gisborne, and he used to maize pick and crib. I don't know if you understand cribbing of maize these days.
No.
Today, people would just not believe what we had to do. The maize was picked by machine, elevated into these cribs that were made of poles with netting and up to about 8 feet, 10 feet high. And you had to fill them, and as you're filling, you had to make sure all the corners were full and then move the elevator over so far, so far, so far. We picked 1,000 acres each year, 3 of us, over a 10-week period. And I have to say that probably they were the best working days of my life. It was absolute fun, meeting the farmers and raiding the orchards. But it was just unreal, quite unreal.
So what did they use the maize for? Was it sold?
Well, the farmers, we never had maize dryers in those days. We're going back into the 1950s, 1956. Maize wasn't dried at all. It was all cribbed. That's how you had to crib it. So the maize wasn't ready to be processed until September. And most farmers had a contract with poultry growers or firms that would take the maize off them. And the shellers would then come in and shell the maize. And that on its own wasn't an easy job. The machine went back into the cribs, and each 6 feet there was a door of the crib. Some of these cribs could be 100 feet long, and there'd be an opening there, and you'd then put the machine there, then you'd lift the thing up so that the maize would glide out, then you had to rake it, then you had to get in and shovel it. And I remember that I think it was the second or third year of doing it. I got to know the guys very, very well. They were all Maori boys, and so my boss wasn't there, so I helped them in the crib. And the idea was last man standing was the champion. And I can remember each one of them just dropping out and dropping out, and I was the last man standing. The boss came up to me and offered me a lot more money than I was earning, and I told my boss at the time he wouldn't let me near them again.
So the maize was animal food?
No, for poultry food. Oh, yeah. Well, what people don't realise, when you're eating cornies, you're only eating the outer layer of the grain. The inner layer, which has all of the energy, is virtually siphoned off, and it goes into hominy meal as a pig food. All you're eating is that outer shell, like the skin of an apple, but it's treated to make it look like that. But going back again, the same time of we were doing this, in my first year of working there, we grew sweet corn, maize and peas, 300 acres, plus the dairy, and I managed it. There was only 35 cows, and then we did the agriculture work, and had planted a crop of fodder beet. I didn't even know what fodder beet was, but I could see that it was doing well. And then he asked me to go down and weed it by hand with a hoe. But he didn't show me how to weed the stuff. I went down with the hoe and I pulled the soil away from the plant, pushed the hoe up to the plant, pulled the soil back, and went down one side and then went down the other. And he had a perfectly weed-free, but a plant that was looking pretty sick. But between each row, and each row was 3 foot, well, I had to thin as well, because in those days you didn't have the prills that they've got today. And you had to hand thin at about 8 inches per plant. We were in our biggest drought that Gisborne had had for many, many moons. We were cutting wood lice down to feed the cows, etc. The crop ended up with like a potato row in the centre, and the beet was down the bottom. And I believe every time it rained, the water went down there. We had the best crop that had ever grown.
So you were taking the soil away from the bulb?
Yeah, but only very small. Yeah.
So what did they do? They cut the tops off to feed?
No, not at all. The plant was growing, and then beautiful crop, had a lovely crop. And because it was going to be used as a supplement over the winter, we had to pull it and store it. And it was put into a dray. A horse dray is what I use with a tractor. And you'd fill it up, and you'd fill it up as many as you could get, and you'd go under the hedge and you would tip it. And it would stay there for 6 months. And it would shrivel, but the value of it was still there because it was condensing itself. And that was the beet. And it left such a huge impression on me. And when I worked out the fact of what you were growing, proportionate to what you get out of grass, the actual return of sustainable product was much more than grass, but you couldn't eat the leaf. You had to be very careful because it's high in oxalic acid and that could kill the cows. But it left a huge impression on my mind. Now, simultaneous to all of this taking place, we also grew sweet corn. And when the machines went through to harvest the corn, as they do today, the stalk is still left in the ground. It surely must have a food value attached if you're in Ireland, and it hadn't been in Ireland, not in Gisborne anyway, or even down here. So I approached Dad, and I was able to put a little pit at home, and I was given a paddock that I could take for nothing, and I was able to get the machinery to harvest it. I harvested the silage, and the object of the whole thing was to fatten the stalk cattle on it, using the fodder beet as a supplement and the corn staver, which was there for nothing. But I mean, there was hundreds and hundreds of acres. So I made the silage, and I was very successful at that. I was still working for this guy for another 3 years after that. But I think this is important to mention as well. I got interested in electronics to a degree, which was whatever was there, and building a Leyden jar caught my eye. And you probably don't know what a Leyden jar is. But if you go to the Faraday Museum, I think there's one over there. But the Leyden jar is a very simple construction of a glass jar lined with, and I had to line this with tin foil taken off cigarette packets in the day. You remember how the cigarettes were in the day? I had to line it, glue it to the outside and glue it to the inside. And the jar is about probably 2 quarts, 3 quarts. And I had to make a wooden cork to put on the top, drill a hole through the centre, drop a copper wire down to make sure it was held there on the top with a bit of a knob, and sit it in the centre, and it would be floating there. And the next thing I had to do was make a kite and run a length of string out, and then attach a thin wire to it with a flash that would capture the lightning bolt. My mum caught up what I was up to, and I never saw it again. Everyone that had done it got killed. Now, this is called the Leyden jar. I was only about 11 then, so I'll cross that one off. Going back, mum's two brothers and sister and their spouses all came out every Sunday afternoon. It was just a tradition. And everyone would sit around the table, and no alcohol, nothing of that nature. It was just tossing everything in. And there'd be huge arguments on the political side, etc. And everybody that was there in the family just remember those political arguments. Now, going back to the maize cobs, I'd read an article in, I think, 1959 or 1960. I've never been able to trace it back to get it definite, where Khrushchev, during the Cold War, I'm not sure whether Diesel or it was prior to what had happened on the Bay of Pigs in Cuba, but he wanted to go to America. And the first stop he wanted to go to was New York, Coney Island, to where they were fattening cattle. And the recipe of the fattening of the cattle was the grinding down of the corn cobs and combining it with urea. The urea was the protein, the corn cobs were the bulk.
Was it corn or was it maize?
No, the cob. You know the cob? The cob that the maize has on it? Oh, yeah, maize. When you're taking the grain off, there'd be massive big bonfire things like this. You had to set fire on.
Yeah.
And they burnt like all
the husk.
No, the husk came off during the process of harvesting. That came off on what they call the husking rod. No, it was the corn cob, the cob itself. And that's when I thought, jeepers, if you can do that, we should be utilising our corn cobs with urea. But I didn't quite understand what urea was, and I don't think anyone did in those early years. And Fonterra have just stopped the farmers from using it as a supplement. Did you know that?
Yeah.
You knew it was being used as a direct supplement? It's the same stuff that you put on the ground?
Yes.
Incredible. But I never got a reply. So that was all right. I was a member of the Young Farmers Club, and I could see the possibility of then using the old freezing mix as a beef fattening unit, and using the silage, the sweet corn stalk that's left, growing the fodder beet to give you a total supplement of feed that was easy to do, as it were, using the old works as a holding pen for fattening. And I was still putting all this together. I then went to Ruakura for 12 months. I'd left my boss and I'd gone to another farm, but the beef prices had fallen and they were going to go into intensive beef, but he had to cut it out. He then wanted me to go to Massey University through the back door. His father-in-law was a professor, but that wasn't on. So I went to Ruakura for 12 months. But at the same time, I took a sample of the silage to just to convince myself of its value, and it came back as a very, very good supplement. And I still have that documentation with the stamp on today. It's somewhere in the room. So that's fine. We had another guy that was an American coming up, just one of the young farmer schemes that they had, with an American, luckily got the draw, came to New Zealand. And I knew he was in New Zealand. He came from the maize growing area in Iowa. And I wanted to contact him, so I knew he was in Auckland. He was taking off, so I hopped on a plane and flew to Auckland without knowing how to find him. I knew he was in Silverdale somewhere, made contact with him. He was so pleased to see me. He came back down. He was flying out the next day. He had a conference final at 10:30, and he said, I can give you the rest of the day. So eventually I found him. We were in Queen Street. He tried to convince me to go into pigs. He said beef would be your secondary. Pigs would be the stable one with an area of what we had. But he said, the book that you need is the one that's used by all the major universities in America. And it's called Feeding Feeding Morrison. And it has every item of foodstuff there that can be utilised into stock food. It was incredible. So he said, we'll try and get it. So we went to all the bookshops, we couldn't get it. Then we went to Technical Books in Queen Street, and there it was upstairs. And that was my Bible over the next few years. But just to emphasise the importance of that book, about 8 years ago, I was invited to a 50th wedding, and one of the guests was a soil scientist by the name of Peter Lester. He'd done a studies in America, and he was telling me this at the table. And I said to him, did you ever come across a book called Feeding, Feeding by Morrison? Yes, he said, that was what we used for everything. And when I came back to New Zealand, I had a suitcase full for my students.
Oh, okay.
So that was only 8 years ago. I couldn't master what we call the nitrogen-free extract. I had no one to work it through, but apart from that, it was very good.
So you were pretty innovative for that time.
I was outside the square.
So were you still a single guy at that stage?
Oh, yes, I was still single.
Yeah, so you could go off and do those things. You didn't have to worry about a family.
Oh, no, no. I courted my wife for 7.5 years. Totally platonic. She was just a lovely, lovely lady. We haven't got very far, have we? So that was all right. I made the silage and the fodder beet. I'd grown the fodder beet, etc. And then I'd gone to Watafata, to the research station. I was there for 12 months. I was very fortunate when I got there that the superintendent that was there when I first approached him, because it was very hard to get in there, had been offered a job at the World Bank in Uruguay for 3 years. And the guy that he was very close to was coming back from getting his doctorate from Cambridge University, a guy called Ian Inkster. And he would only go to Uruguay if Ian would take his job at Spotify. And that's what happened. But that's when I got very close to Ian. He was the one that helped me go through all these other bits and pieces and etc. That type of life wasn't for me because it's regimented to a degree where it's so easy, you know. I mean, it was ridiculous. We were housed in lovely accommodation. We had the cooks doing all the meals during the week, but on the weekend you had to cook for yourself. Mm-hmm. But you had to put your hours down for how long it took you to cook and get paid for it. It was crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, farms after that sort of started trying that, didn't they?
No, no, it never happened.
It didn't happen.
No, it didn't happen. No, no. Good question, though, and I'll come back onto that again as years have gone on, if I remember. I could interrupt that now at this point with the question you've asked. Going back to my brother, who was a shemilk, and then he bought his own farm down Rangitata, I kept at him to grow fodder beet for the cows during the off-season. This is 25 years ago. And if he wanted a hand, I'd be down there to help him. The way they were farming then, all the cows were moved off the farm and they went to graziers. It was so easy. Strip the farm of all stock, put the graziers out, pay the graziers, and it was huge money they were paying. But the price of the return of the milk was so great that it was an easier lifestyle. But then, I think around about 2012, 2013, when the price plummeted, they couldn't afford to pay the graziers. So I tried to kill my brother again, the grow fodder beet. And eventually he did. And from not having any fodder beet grown in the South Island, today there's about 48,000 hectares. And it's a supplement that's used. I know it upsets a lot of the greenies, but it's a food thing there. What you get back is far greater than anything else you can grow. And you can store it. I've digressed a wee bit on that. Mm-hmm. So, and every year he says to me now, and he's growing his fodder beet for 5-6 years, you save me $180,000 each year. Anyway, going back to the freezing, we still haven't dealt with the freezing works, have we? So I went to the works and I went up to see the guys that were leasing it. It was in the same people's hands since 1929. I put a proposition to them. At the same time, the local fertiliser company, Field Air, were using the second floor as aircraft storage from the Second World War. The whole area was covered. A lot of the parts were still in their shellac and their paper. We were able to do a deal with Field Air and they moved into what we call the administration building. And we took over the three floors. We were going to set it up as a piggery. And we started. But I got married at this stage. I had no job when I came back on my honeymoon. We built a new home. I bought 5 acres, built a new home on it. And I was shoe milking 2 miles away, so my mortgage was being paid by the farm owner. We had no house on the farm. And at the same time I was doing that, I wanted to set up the piggery as well. So I went up and was able to come to an arrangement. The guy that was up there at that stage was growing mushrooms as a living. And he was doing very well out of it. Then I stopped the shear milking and we started setting up the piggery. Now, our first pig pens were tiger moth wings. We used them as the...
As the pens for the pigs.
Yeah.
Well, where did you get those wings from?
The Field Air left them behind on the second floor.
Oh, right.
Along with 2 reconditioned tiger moth motors, but had lost the log, so they couldn't do anything with them. Anyway, I'll move on.
How long did you have the piggery?
I can't remember, but a lot of things happened over that period.
So the pigs were sold, what, to the local butchers or something?
Yes, we sold the pigs to the local butchers. We were one of the biggest producers. Right. If we'd have kept that going as the potential that it had, we'd have been the biggest piggery in New Zealand. 600 sows, we could have run 600.
So they were all inside, they weren't outside?
Everything was inside, and all the drainage was there.
Yeah.
So away we go, we set up this piggery. Simultaneous to that, Gold Top Brewery, the old brewery in Gisborne. Yeah. Does that ring a bell with you?
Not that name.
Gold Top. No. DJ Barry's Gold Top. Yeah. That's where my dad worked for 14 years. It closed, and they just wanted everything removed. And I was able to go through, and we bought a lot of pumps and stuff that saved thousands of dollars. And we were able to take that out, all done legally. And we set up the piggery. We put in a big Myers bulldozer pump, which we got from the brewery. We dropped it down where the 1931 earthquake had been at the works and blocked the flow of the water. Well, we dropped the pipe down that's running to this day. My wife and I put up the finance to set it off to buying the sows and to moving through, etc. And at the same time, we had a contract with Watties, and we were taking all of the Watties foods. Very much like Steiner's here in Hawke's Bay used to take Watties food by the truckload and take it out to
the yard. For feed.
Yeah, well, we were in the same boat as that in Gisborne. We only had two trucks, but we were able to utilise that food. And then we needed to automate it, and unfortunately for me, I had a bad accident and lost an arm, so I was out of fishing for a wee while. I was also delegate for the Pig Council as well, and Poverty Bay had a great field advisory officer on pigs. He was brilliant, Steve Rees. He was just magic, and he set up an awful lot of piggeries. But at the same time, another guy, Jock Booth, who was an engineer in Taupo, had set up a piggery off Spar Road, and he'd done it in conjunction with the owner of the Spar Hotel, Jim Binney. They'd set it all up, and they were going for some years, and it was all automated. You just had to walk around. It was heated, naturally, and all the food was mixed through a cooker, which was then dropped down into the main holding tank, and they pulled away from Reparoa with two D1000 truck and trailer units. But they were big time. But unfortunately, they built it on a 10-year block of Maori land, and Maori wanted it back to convert into a caravan home, so we had to get out. There was no one in New Zealand could take the equipment, and we went through and offered a price on it and took it all back. This is 1972. Brought all the equipment through, the boilers. Now, we had to get another boiler, which we got locally. We managed to get the tanks in and put the tanks on the second floor. Everything was in duplicate to pump the food out, inch pipe. Then I had a bad accident and I lost an eye. And it sort of put me out of commission for a while. And the guy that I was in partners with just didn't quite work out as it should have. I was going to buy him out and I was going to buy the works. So again, I approached the local Gisborne Chief Powers and I was turned down. So I went to the local MP, Esme Tomlinson, and told her what we had. We were actually doing a service for the community at that stage. Esme approached the Australasian Managing Director for the whole of Nelson's, Tuona, and all these other things that they had, to see if we couldn't purchase. She did the groundwork for me, rang me up, and said, whatever plans you've got, fire ahead. It'll go through in a fortnight. The price was incidental because we knew that we'd be safe.
So by that time, you must have had a fair few pigs.
Oh, yes.
I mean, wouldn't have been just supplying the Gisborne area, it would be
national. Yeah, we were sending them outside as well.
So were they actually killed there and sent out as carcasses or sent live?
We could kill them in Gisborne and send them to the local butcher shop, although because we're dealing with Watties and they wanted a big number of hams, we could do it. The local butcher who had taken over the running of the local abattoir didn't like that and he stopped us from killing them, wanting to kill the pigs in Gisborne. That was a 24-hour session. You couldn't do that. We jumped up and down. No names mentioned. So everything was getting automated. A couple of funny stories. Can I add those in?
Yes.
Two funny stories. I'll get locked up today for this one. We were having to put a 24-inch culvert through from the main building. We had a cesspit that we took. When we took all the equipment from the brewery, we also had to buy a 4-ton, 3-foot radius with a 6-foot bed lathe. We didn't even have to lift it up. A guy by the name of Peter Holsworth, who Holsworth's a Tikaraka, they're big forestry people. The boy, Peter, was one of the first to get computerisation on farming. He wanted the lathe, but he also had a drag line in those days. So we swapped the lathe for the drag line to dig this huge pool. And only you had to have that. That was an aerobic, anaerobic thing to take the effluent away. This particular day, we're putting a 24-inch track through, and the guy selling American Eagle insurance comes right up to us, chops his car, jumps out. Gentlemen, I've got just the thing for you, he says. Everyone around the area has signed up for this insurance. Got all the names. They should never probably have done it, but we weren't interested. And he turns to my brother and says, well, are you interested? And Peter said, no. Well, what are you doing? And we told him what we were doing, but he didn't believe us. And then he was getting quite obnoxious. And I said to my brother, I'm going to give him a 3-minute fuse. 1-minute fuse, 1 foot, 2 foot, 3 foot is 3 minutes. And I lit it. And his car's only 6 feet away. And I realised I shouldn't have done that. And so, in no uncertain terms, we convinced him that if he didn't get out, he was going to be toast. So he puts it in reverse, we started pushing him back. And then we had the scarper. And he gets around, goes back 50 metres, does a side turn and goes out, and up it went like this. The last we saw him was waving his fist, saying every... Never saw him again. One of the other incidents following through, we had to then put in the three-phase power. We had the effluent pumps all there, been running for 2 years, had a big crust on them. And the electricians had come out and were doing the job, and one of the guys wanted to go to the loo. So he just goes from the corner of the building to the other building, and he just kept walking. He disappeared into the effluent.
Oh, no.
And the third one was, when we first got married, there was this farming group there, but two lots were part of the nudist colony. I mean, there wasn't our scene to be in the nudist colony, my wife and I, but we still, you know, you communicate, etc. And one day he came to me and he said, "Hugh, we've lost the area where we've got to be, and we're looking for a new area." I said, "Oh, third floor of the freezing works, it's open, it's got 35,000 square feet." And I'd never said it. They came out, they had a look. And I'm thinking, oh, what am I going to tell my wife? And then the smell put them off.
Oh, no.
Anyway, we go back to the property. The way we got settled. And then, unfortunately, we were building up our gilts. We had 80 gilts for the new stock that was coming through. A gilt is a female maiden sow. And they were all probably 3-4 weeks off farrowing, maybe even closer. And suddenly they started to abort. And leptospirosis went through the whole 80, and that was one of the bigger knocks that we had. But we got over that, and we were then building up, and as I said earlier, we were going to buy the works, and the locals had turned us down, but the pressure was put on them from the Australasian Managing Director, Roger Golding, and so whatever plans, fire ahead. And I signed an unconditional bill of sale 2 days later to sell for 5 acres in the new house, so we had the cash to do what we wanted to do. 2 weeks later, I went through, we were turned down again. I went back to the guy that was going to buy the house, and he wanted the equivalent of today, $55,000, to call the deal off. An uncle of mine came out and wanted me to take the money, but he was prepared back, but we were too proud to. So we went to Auckland, to a big piggery at Hallowies. Left the piggery, sold the interest in the piggery. But there's still more to come.
So you went to a piggery up Auckland?
Went to a piggery in Auckland, Hallowies. They were producing 45,000 bakers at Parata.
What was the fascination with pigs?
Well, I'd already got to that point and I had the knowledge of it all, but I didn't really like pigs. My brother-in-law asked me that not so long ago.
It must have been easier in those days dealing with it, though.
It was totally different. But when I went to Hallowies, and they were doing it on a scientific basis as a means of tax evasion, but at the same time, growing the mushrooms, I'm digressing, but the guy that I went into the pastorship was growing mushrooms, and he rings me up one night and he's as excited as anything. He says, "You've got to come out, I've got great news for you." My wife and I went out, and it turns out his godmother had died, who was Rose Hallaby, one of the major Hallaby. She was his godmother and had left him an amount of money. He had to go into mushrooms. And if he challenged the will of a going to grass in his vision, he challenged the will. And I said to Simon, "Use the money to buy what we need for the piggery and we'll just pay you back, but make it as a mushroom thing. I mean, you need a tractor, you need a this and that." But he didn't want it. And he lost it, which is crazy. So that was all right.
So how long were you in Auckland with your pigs?
I went to Hallaby's. I was there for 12 months, and I didn't like the attitude of how they treated their staff. I mean, I was all right because I had the experience. They had this new guy come along. He was doing well, and one day they decided they didn't want him, so they put him on a bus, and he had nowhere to go. So I saw an ad in the paper from one of the shoemaker.
Where was that?
Cracker. Just down the road from where the piggery was. So I applied for it, and I had my brother with me at that stage. He was up on holiday. And I was growing a moustache, and I thought, I can't go to an interview with a moustache. So I had my electric thingy there. So I took it up and got halfway, and the battery went down. So I went home, didn't go to the interview. Went back the next day. Anyway, we got the job, and we were then going to be shear milking town milk in Auckland.
So how long did you do that?
3 years, but there's a story attached to that as well. The first year we were there was the biggest drought that Auckland had had in 70 years. We'd gone to Karaka, Lewis Road, didn't know anybody, and for the first 2 or 3 months, I was trying to sort out the way the farm operated, etc., and I could see there was no water table. So I moved everything forward, the haymaking and silage, etc., and was able to get away with it. We're the only one in the district, and I believe I might have been the laughing stock, I'm not sure. But at the end of the season, we were the only ones that supplied quota without any supplement. the dairy board came to ask me if we'd open the farm up to the local farmers, and I had over 300 farmers from South Auckland come on the farm. The owners didn't know, they'd gone to Australia and they were mining for sapphires. They'd given up farm to go mining for sapphires.
So you really had an innovative mind to be able to do what you did, because I mean you're obviously a leading person.
There's more to come too with the pot of it, because that's only recent.
And did you have family at that stage?
Oh yes, I had three daughters.
So were they born up there? Born in
Gisborne. Yeah. It was the time of the Harvey Crew murders. A couple of them living in the farmhouse, which we didn't need. We had a huge, huge homestead house that we were living in. It was owned by restauranters in the 1930s. They'd come from Pukekaua, and they reckoned the guy was totally innocent. They knew him and reckoned he was innocent, and etc. And that was interesting to get that feedback from there. But the first year we were there, we opened the farm up, the invitation of the dairy board, and I can still see them coming around and asking me questions and saying, but he's got weeds. And I just turned around and said, it's medicinal. I walked the farm every day. I knew what was going on. It was just the way it was. And we were lucky to get away with it. But I do believe that that particular farm in the early 40s, I found out later, one of the fertilisers they used heavily is called Basic Slag. Does it ring a bell with you? Right. It's a product of manufacturing iron. It's a low releasing phosphate, and I believed I must have got the benefit of that too, because I was doing things that others couldn't do, and could only put it down to that. So anyway, we were there for the first year, we did that. The second year we were cruising along, we got increased quota. The third year I got a letter saying that they wanted us for another 3 years and thanks for increasing the quota, etc. And out of the blue, 6 weeks before, they came back and they wanted to sell the farm. Out of the blue. And the reason for it was the Bjelke Petersen, Premier of Queensland, had changed the mining rights where they were, and they had 4 weeks to get onto the ground floor of being stabilised and the mining rights for themselves. So they wanted to sell quickly. And we should have bought it, but we didn't. Simultaneous to that, my wife's family were running the catering at Tanona Canteen. And they offered this.
So that's where your catering started?
I've never cooked a meal in my life. Well, in those days you were farming, so life was so different.
So you had to learn very quickly.
Oh, very quickly. Very quickly. It wasn't difficult.
It was a bit different, though, to dealing with, you know, everyday work with animals, wasn't it?
Both of them were pigs.
I mean, you'd spent all those years, you know, farming, and then suddenly you had to change career.
Well, yeah, I come down, and I overheard someone say, he won't last a year. I thought, well, okay, I'll fix you. And then, of course, we had the big fire at Tanona, and we were in the old building at that stage. The building that where the catering was sort of off-site where the barracks used to be, and the union, the secretary, the president, all those guys were in the same building as we were at the back, and we had no problem at all. It was really good.
So you would have been catering for, you know, quite a number of people.
At the peak, everyone came, 2,000.
And doing, what, 3 meals a day? Because people at shift work.
No, the shift work, we did meals at night, but once the barracks went, it was all takeaway foods. But I had to start at 2 in the morning and accept it, but we had some funny stories there to tell as well. Some of the classics.
You probably had to learn by your mistakes, did you?
Oh, well, my auntie and my wife's mother were there to start with. I just observed. I changed everything pretty soon. They'd go around and collect the bread. Then they'd slice it. You could buy sliced bread for the same price. And I changed everything that direction, and it wasn't too fun.
So how long were you doing that?
About 9 years, 9, 10 years.
Was it from there that you went on to the catering you did here in Havelock?
We went to Splash Planet. We were there, yeah. Then we went to the Havelock Community Centre. The council asked us to go in there. And then I sold that, but that, unfortunately, it didn't work out, and I was going on tour for several, and I think we lost 200,000. But that's life. You get on with it. Just get on with it. Funny stories. You've got to laugh. These are good stories to tell.
No names.
Oh, no names. In the afternoon, we had a particular group of 11, which all would come over. So 20 past 3, they're always going to be there. If we had food left over...
Where was that, Splash Planet or Havelock?
No, the Tanona. If there was food left over, we literally gave it to them. But if not, and they wanted to make that problem, we only charged them the basic. We looked after them. And this particular day, they came over and they were all laughing. They didn't see me at the back. They knew that my wife, Norma, was in the front. And they saw Norma and didn't know I was on the back. And they said, oh, Norma, we've got something for you. And they were all laughing their heads off. Oh, thank you, boys. What have you got? And they rolled a sheep's eye down the counter. And my wife turned around and said, oh, no, that's not for you. They've got something for you. Come and have a look. So I go around the front. And then sheep's eye. Oh, they're all laughing away there. I said, oh, thank you very much, boys. And I grabbed the serviette and I picked it up. I said, look at that. I said, right size, right shape, right colour. Whipped out my glass.
Oh, no.
They just bolted. So, yeah, that was Tanona. There's lots of things happening there.
That would be an interesting place to be, though.
Oh, totally, totally. And we treated everyone equally. Everybody was treated the same. You couldn't make too many friends because it was difficult. But if someone had died, in one case there, a young guy, a very good customer, his wife died of an asthma attack with six kids. So we'd go around every night and take food to them. And one night we went around there and there were six adults all drunk on the floor and I never went back. But those kids never forgot us. We saw them years later and they were just... It's amazing.
Mm. So what did you do in those days with leftover food?
Oh, they either took it or we gave it away. Never had anything for the next day. Mm. No, not at all. Right from the beginning, when we first went there, and I was totally green on everything, I remember the rubbish man would come and take the rubbish, and he came in one day and the rubbish would be on one side and he had blood and bone on the other. I said, gee, that'll go well in the garden. When I got home, there was two big bags in the boot of my car. So I said to my wife, I said, we're not taking that. And I took it back, because I didn't take it out of the car. And the next afternoon, I waited for him, and I said, don't you ever do that to me again. I said, take it out of the thing. That's how we operated. We're there, what, 8-9 years, no contract. A key, 24/7, to the whole facility. 2 weeks before, the manager called me over, David Guscott, and said, I think you better sign this for the new contract. There was 15 clauses. But, I know, we had some good times there. It was good. But we left that. One of the guys who was working for me wanted to go into business at Splash Planet. In those days, it was Windsor Lodge. And he was a chef from London, and he was good. And I was going to be the lackey. I was quite happy just to do whatever. And he was a wonderful guy, a charmer, a real charmer. But that was his problem.
It wasn't a full year, was it?
Oh, no.
No, but work wasn't for the full year, because the Splash Planet was never open.
Oh, no, it was always open in those early days. Yeah, before Splash Planet, it was always open. Always, every weekend. Mm. But we did weddings and, the big rooms there. But unfortunately, Tom, his name was Tom, and I don't blame him, he just couldn't leave the woman alone. And, you know, you're doing a function, he's just not there.
That was your start of being involved with catering?
At Timona.
Yeah, I mean, catering for functions.
Oh, yes, yeah, that's the start.
Which would have been a little bit different to what you were doing
at Timona. Oh, it was totally different. Yeah. I realised, and I said to Tom, I said, look, it's not going to work out. I was going to buy him out. I said, now, what I want to do is, when you do an interview, etc., I want to just be with you and write down notes. And when you're cooking, I want to watch what you're doing. I mean, if he walked in there now, all I'd say to us, keep your hands in your pockets, Pom. He didn't stick to the recipes, everything was different. I said, it's got to be the same. And that's how I did it, made sure that everything was the same.
So his recipes were in his head and he just did them as he...
Yeah, that's right. He nearly got killed over in England when he was a young fellow jumping on the back of trains. He said he went 40 k's at the back of the train and they were lucky to survive. Mm.
So then when you came out here to catering, it must have been very different because you'd be catering for a different purpose.
Oh yes, we were catering for a totally different purpose. But then we had 70 clubs that we were looking after.
When you're at Splash Planet?
At Splash Planet. We had 70 different groups as regulars from Rotary.
People who came in for meals or ones you applied?
No, the ones that come in for weddings and they sort of followed us out there. But when we got out to the
community centre,
to this family there, and it wasn't finished, I could see that it just didn't look right. So I brought in, what was her name? She was Chef of the Year twice, and we needed anything special. She was going to be the one that would do it. But when she came into the kitchen, she just swore and said, oh, not another one. We had to change the whole thing. They had to pull walls out, and I went and got Gibson Patterson came in and restructured the whole thing. Pulled out two walls and redid it.
When you were down here, were you just catering for people on site or did you go out?
We were doing off site as well. We ended up with the Havelock Club, the Hiratonga Club, and we did a lot of catering for the Masonic Lodge. We went everywhere. Oh. Funerals. I think in the course of the year when we were there, or we were doing funerals from original, we did over 6,000 funerals.
And they still do funerals, don't they?
Pure do, yes. And they're very good.
They took over from you?
No. It's been three changes since then. Yeah, I sold it.
So what was the business called when you were there?
Regal Catering.
How long were you there?
Oh, 2004 I finished.
So when did you start there?
1995 or somewhere there.
When you left there, where did you go? Or did you retire?
No. We built a new home in Hart Drive. And I was semi-retired. My son-in-law was farming down opposite Mount Bruce, and he was the farm supervisor there. It was a new dairy conversion that they were doing. They were short of staff, etc., so I'd go down and give them a hand to do a bit of water.
So farming never ever got out of your blood, did it?
I know, there's a nice story attached. It's almost unbelievable. So we went down. I left my daughter living here for I don't know how many years. We were down there, and I was going backwards and forwards. Then I was offered a job down there to do herd management of the herds. Oh, no, I did the water line, then I did the fencing, and then was split into two herds, took over one of the herds. And then the owners decided they wanted to go overseas and invest overseas. So they went to China, the English problem, South America, too many guns, went to the States, and they thought they'd buy a farm over there. My son-in-law went over with them, and they went right over to Mississippi, Minnesota, I think, and that area there, Georgia, and they decided to buy a farm. And I'm down here on the farm. This is 6 weeks, and I said to my daughter, the talk I'm hearing, you guys are going to be out here in 6 weeks. And the boss came up and asked me, well, you guys, Norman, you go over to the States and help set up the dairy farm?
So did you?
Yeah. Then he rings me up and said, I think you need another guy. And my brother was standing beside me. He'd retired, engineer, and just what we needed. And there was no sitting around the table at all. We just laid that everything. Everything was paid for. Got to America. No briefing or anything. Got a wee bit lost. We went to Georgia. And we couldn't get on the farm. It wasn't fully paid for. It took about 8 days, I think, before that was sorted. We were with two of the owners. Still waiting for a briefing. And then they get on the farm, and they're there for about 8 days. They turn around and say, well, you guys are settled in. Well, here we're going home.
So you had to set it up?
We set it up. We started from scratch. We had a ring fence. It was all do the fencing and then do the water lines and then work out where the dairy was going to be, etc. Then he turned around and he said, oh, look, here's my Rabobank card. Do you take that? And my wife wouldn't wear that one. So he had to get his chequebook and he just kept signing the checks out. And that's what we did. So they went home.
So where were they from? New Zealand?
Yeah, New Zealand. Yeah.
So how many years were you in America?
No, no, we only have to set the dairy up, only for 90 days, beginning. So I had no visa, shouldn't have been there.
The green card, I think you have, don't you?
We had to have the certification of somebody with the certificate of operation for running of a dairy farm in conjunction with the effluent, required fertiliser, balanced fertiliser, water, etc., etc., etc. And I had to go to the Georgian Farm Bureau. And they told me, just go there and you'll sign a few papers. When I got there, it was 2 days and there was 17 lectures. And if you didn't pass, come back next year. We arrived there, my wife and my brother, and I got to drop me off. And I said to my wife, I said, look, you better give me my passport. And then when I opened up, I just realised what we'd done. You shall not go to any school of learning and you shall not work. I just shut it up and I said, look, if I'm not back in half an hour, you guys can go. And I got up there, and 5 stories up, and I was introduced as the guest from New Zealand.
Exciting.
Oh, it was magic. Absolutely magic. Yeah. And I passed, got the thing through.
So is that farm still gone?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. Yeah. So I was going back and do another one, but I ended up with cancer. But that was
so,
in Georgia.
Your career has gone from one extreme to the other.
Oh, absolutely. But I haven't finished even on the thing with it. If anyone in the bay with the fodderby, I'd go and help them. If they want to plant a proper fodderby. No, I'm talking about
you think
that.
You're the expert.
I would turn around and only an acre or 2 acres.
Yeah.
We'd do it by hand and we'd weed it, etc. We did one for Tony Ironside, who's well into his 80s. I was putting one in. I knew Tony through running in the Harriers. We went into a drought. It was really dry, really, really dry. And my brother had come down and have a look at what we were up to as well. So we decided that we would do a rain dance. And we did this rain dance. I'm in a bag for colon cancer. And my brother's filming me and I'm making all these weird noises. The bag is going up and down like this on the video later on. And the guy's coming down on his motorbike. I wonder if Tony's name's. I recognise him from being at Timon. I'm curious then. I've heard a lot of strange noises. Has Tony been attacked by a boar? So, anyway, definitely. Yeah, right. Yeah. When we went to the States, I've got to tell this story as well. When we went over there, we were very, very well received. They just did not want us to come away. It was wonderful. But the guy that we had to bring in to do a lot of contracting work for us, Doug Schmidt was his name, and within a matter of about 3 or 4 weeks, things were starting to dry out. And he said to me, what's the weather going to do here? And I said, oh, Don, I said, next Tuesday the heavens will open up, you'll get all you need. And you know, then. So that was all
someone
right.
Was looking after you.
Oh, no, yeah, but it was a bit scary. Then he laughed and we laughed and etc. He said, oh, newcomers always do that. 3 or 4 weeks ago again. Drought conditions again, come back to me, phew, he said, got it right last time, did he get it right this time? And I said to him, yep, no problem, Doug. I said, Friday, heavens will open up. Friday, heavens open up. When it rained, you've got a huge doubt now, so he's probably seeing the golf courses. But that was all right. We went back to say our goodbyes with the people who had made contact with him, etc. And the last thing he said, well, here he says, you guys, I don't know why you guys are going home, he says, but anyway, you're going, what's the weather going to be? And I said to Tony, and I looked him in the eye, and I looked to the east, I looked to the west, I turned my back, I looked to the south, and I looked him back in the eye, and I said, Tony, I have no idea why I said this. You're going to go into big trouble. You're going to go into the biggest drought you've ever experienced. came home.
And did it happen?
5 months later, pick up the New Zealand Dominion. It's a photo of Georgian farmers praying for rain on the steps of Parliament.
I'm amazed at how innovative you were to start, you know, and going from your farming and being able to do what you thought you should do, and then moving on into catering, and then going to America.
That was in 2006, then. That's that long ago.
So if you go back to pig farming in Gisborne, is it still there? Is someone still running that farm?
I know very well. All that equipment we put in is still there.
And is it being used?
No.
Mind you would have had pens, which they probably wouldn't have liked today.
Oh, exactly. But, I mean, that's another story. Yeah. There's a huge story attached to that one. I sold it to my partner, who was going to pay me over some years, and he rings up one day, and he's crying on the phone. His wife had left him. He didn't know what he was up to. And I might have said, just buy me a couple of cows and we'll call the debt. But he owed me thousands and thousands. And that was that. So I was shoemaking and came down here. And then, I think, was it the first or second year? Big headlines. It was a big drug bust up there.
Is that what it was being used for?
Being used
for. Would have been making some money.
Yeah, but I was called into the trials. I had the evidence, but I put him away.
Your name still wasn't on things, obviously.
Oh, well, the lease was still in my name, and the cash that they found there, technically speaking, probably I could have put my name to it, but I wouldn't. There was $55,000 in 73.
So going back to your parents in Gisborne, they stayed there?
Oh, never moved, they stayed there.
Your dad was a farmer?
No, David did share with him for a while, but he was a labourer. He was called up to the army in 1942, and he was doing his training down in Greytown. He was there for, I don't know for how long, but he was going on the route march, and he collapsed, and he came right. Went on another route march, I believe, and he collapsed again, and he had a sore stomach. And I don't know what happened there, but he went into one of the army surgeons, and he said, I don't know what's wrong, you've got bowel cancer. So he opened him up, and he had bowel cancer. Twice, Mum was sent down to the Greytown Hospital. I think it was Greytown, is it? Where the hospital was there? Do you remember when the Japanese army...
Featherstone. Just this side of Featherstone.
Yeah, that's right. Because the hospital was right beside them. Mum and Dad were down there at the time. And Mum was called down twice to be with him. He wasn't pulled through. He was so crook. And Mum always told the story the second time. They were convalescing and walking through Featherstone. And one of the orderlies that was on duty at the time, and Dad was really crook, he saw Dad, and he goes as white as a ghost. And he says, Jesus, bloody Christ, Bill Thornton, the last time we saw you, we were laying you on the slab.
So he was very lucky by the sound of things.
Yeah, very lucky. Mm.
You said you've got three daughters. They were all born and brought up in Gisborne.
All born in Gisborne, yes.
What are they doing now?
Nicola's asleep at the moment. She's going to work at Royston shortly. Debbie's marriage has just broken up, unfortunately, but she's working at Royston as well in the kitchen. For 14 years, she had Caccini and Havelock North, Caccini Cafe. She then put all the kids through school. She had four daughters and a son, and Joanne is working out at Hagee, out at Clifton.
Yeah, so they're all here. It's really nice. Nice support for you.
Oh, it's unreal. I've got three daughters, 12 grandchildren, 19 greats.
Oh, wow.
19 greats. And we had a christening. One of the ones at my church, St. Columbus, she wanted the baby to be christened. And I think it almost doubled in size.
Yeah,
that's
nice.
It was lovely. It was only about 3 weeks.
And did you have other interests outside your farming and catering?
Oh, yes. Amateur radio. Yeah. And I dropped it for quite a while. I'm just setting myself up again now. During the big storm, one of the wires came out of the rotator that I got. It cost me $1,100 from Australia. And I resold it, but I can't see the finish, and I think I've blobbed everything together. Can't see properly. I'm making another one out the front.
What do you do with that?
Talk around the world. Yeah, but you've got to be licensed for it. I've actually been licensed since 1980, but I haven't been active for a long time. But it was quite funny. I went back to the club last year, all new faces. Now, I was introduced as Hugh. Some of you probably don't know him simply. He was our treasurer secretary in 1980.
During the cyclone, they were using the, what is it called, the SAT, Sky Communication.
No, we have our own, I've got a room down the back there full of radios, and the boys were there, but I wasn't feeling too good there at that stage anyway, I've got to be a bit careful.
Were you involved in anything else?
I've been president of the Hawke's Bay Ostomy Group for 12 years, and I'd resigned last year, and no one's filled the gap, and we might end up closing. It's just very sad.
That happens today. A lot of people don't want to take over.
No. I've convened it for two conferences, one in 2011 and one in 2021. We did very well out of it. The last one we had at the centre, and it was magic. And we made over $5,000 both times. We netted 5,000 at the end.
Yeah. So you've obviously been retired for a while. Do you have other interests, or is it all family?
No. I've done a lot of work up at the cemetery when my wife died 4 years ago. They made a big error on the day that we were going up to lay her ashes to rest. Nicola went up the day before to check everything out, but they put her stone in the wrong place and they dug out the wrong thing there. But that didn't matter. I mean, that was sort of thing. My wife would have just laughed at that.
I'm going to go right back. Who was your wife?
Norma Gail Trowell.
Was she brought up here?
Gisborne girl. We met each other. She was 14 and I was 15.
Young mother.
Yes, on the skating rink, Gisborne, Alfred Cox Park. We courted each other for 7.5 years.
So she must have been a pretty resilient wife to cope with you with all the different things you were doing.
Yes, yeah. never ever complained.
And particularly as sometimes you were starting new innovative things, yes, that meant that you perhaps didn't spend as much time together.
Well, we worked together on the farm. We worked together all our lives, yeah. And the girls, they just look at us that it was so unique, because we never argued. She was just, there's no point in arguing. She was too nice.
I mean, you know, if we didn't have people like you who were prepared to work through new things and new ideas, you know, we'd all be at a bit of a standstill, wouldn't we?
Oh, absolutely. With the farming venture, with the fodder beet itself, and knowing the full value of it, and how to move the crop forward to get the best results so that in a dry season, looking at Hook's Bay, where you've done the right things, I did an experiment down in Rangitata, South Island, in 2015. My brother was putting in fodder beet, and I got the plants struck at Awapuni Nurseries in Palmerston North. 1,000 plants. I didn't have to pay for the shipping that they were delivered to Rangitata, because they were moving stuff down there anyway. Yeah. And the four of us planted the plants, and at that stage, October the 6th, October the 7th, the plants were about this big. So normally you're sowing the seed. Suddenly we've got them that big by mid-January. We had, I think, going on for nearly 28,000.
So this fodder beet, is that mainly grown and used by dairy farms?
In New Zealand it is, but its cousin, sugar beet, it's a cross between sugar beet and mangel.
Some of those, though, are used by beef farmers, aren't they?
Yes, some of the sun farmers used to grow it, yes.
Because I was brought up on a farm, and the only things I can remember was turnips and swedes.
Both of those are brassicas. The fodder beet are what we call a vetivirus. Botanical is vetivirus, where the botanical for turnips and swedes and rape and that sort of thing is brassica. Two different families, totally two different types of result. Right. With the fodder beet, you can get a yield of up to 35,000 kilos of dry matter per hectare if you do it properly.
Some farmers in New Zealand are still growing it.
The South Island, 45,000 hectares. That's a huge amount of dairy farming. It's causing a bit of a kerfuffle with the greenies at the moment because of the high nitrates level, but you don't fertilise nitrates on fodder beet. They don't respond to it the same. And they have a big long taproot and they go right down and can absorb the moisture.
All right.
We grew in 2015 this crop, and it was very, very successful. And it was ready to harvest if we wanted it by mid-January, which meant that if you'd done that, say, up here, and you've got a drought in January, we've got that crop there for you. Mm. But you had to do it by hand. But then there's machinery around the world. If you did it on a bigger scale, it would absolutely push it forward. So that was the last thing I've been up to.
So you're sort of an expert on it. Well, you're very knowledgeable about it, put it that way.
It's cold-faced stuff.
But that's one thing you were prepared to try.
And I was lucky enough to be able to do it. I made what we call dibbles. Yeah. You know what a dibble is? Okay, you buy them, they've got a thingy, and you push them in the ground. Oh. So I made these dibbles to go down, and I had two dibbles, and we had four of us planting. Each one had a nickname. I was just lucky to be able to do it. Yeah. My eldest brother, we were actually doing a pre-planting on that particular day, the 6th of October 2015, at the reserve just out here in Havelock, where they've done all that housing, Palmbrook. And we planted a tow truck. As you're walking back, I said, well, I'm off to Ashburton in a couple of hours, coming down. And my granddaughter was there as well. You want your ticket, Pop? She did. By the time we got to the car, this ticket was already booked.
Yeah.
Three of us went down, and there was four of us planting. But it was all over in about 3 hours.
Going back to your pig farming days, would computers have been an aid to you? Or?
You mean, were they there then?
No. I know they weren't there then, but some of the technology that we have today would have changed what you did in the past.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, because you've got access to so much information.
Yeah. But I also think you being a country boy, you obviously had time to go and do the things you wanted to do, and you were able to do them, and that obviously was the Brownlings for where you've gone since.
I think so, and I think when I left school and you could see the waste of Bonmai, as I said earlier on, with the sweet corn stover, then with Khrushchev, etc. If you go back with the harvesting, how we cribbed cobs, when you went through the machines, the stalk is hit with what they call the snapping roll, and it goes up to the elevator, and then there's husk. Yeah, and when that impact of the snapping roll is hitting that stalk, you lose about 8 grains, and there's always a trail of grain on the ground. Then you run pigs through to utilise it. Well, if you had the pigs. But once they brought in the machinery where it was cut off and then pushed through the machines on the tractor itself, the yields went straight up because that maize was all being gathered.
Didn't farmers go through those paddocks with their harrows and harrow that in?
No, they would have gone through the discs. They'd have gone through the discs.
So they would have been fertilising the field before it was replanted.
Well, it still takes a while for it to break down and to become a nutrient type of thing. Then it's ploughed in, actually.
But that must sort of aerate the soil, or, you know, loosen the soil up, make it better.
Absolutely. And the way that they do it now with the assembly of machinery they've got, where they can just go through with a thin strip of, say, 150 millimetres, and that would be worked out, and that's where the crop goes this time. And then next year it's over here, the next year it's over here, and then it comes back, so that you've got to spread out on the thing with it. But with the quite a bit, the rows were 500 millimetres apart, the plants were 300 millimetres apart, so then that's how we worked it straight through. It was stony soil, and we couldn't get the dribble to go down, so we had a crowbar there, it was absolutely perfect with the shape. One of my nephews pushed it in, and my brother came along. What did we call him? The plonker was the guy that made the hole. The presenter was the one that presented the plant. We had four names. And it worked out. But the shea milking that I did pretty much after we got married, it was very high producing there because we were able to get the brewer's grain from the local brewery. And that was fed into the troughs on the front, and that really made the cows milk.
So when you were shea milking, was the milk sent to be processed in Gisborne?
The milk from Gisborne was processed in Gisborne. That was tankered. But in the early days, when Dad was shea milking, the milk went straight into 12-gallon cans. When we were shea milking in Auckland, and we were the proxy voters for the owners, because they weren't there, it was quite interesting. I had to represent them on two different AGMs. And on the second AGM, I think it was, we had it in Auckland. And Auckland Milk was the biggest milk company in New Zealand. And there's this gentleman sitting at the back, very, very quiet. And when it was all over giving the figures and it came to general business, he stood up and he said, "Look, I'm an accountant. I don't understand why you've presented these figures like they are." And there was a deathly silence came over the room, and the reporters and anyone else that wasn't there in proxy or whatever were all asked to leave the room. And then it was explained our opposition was sanitarium, and they were actually double dipping on one of the milk products because they were the first ones to bring in yogurts, dairy yogurts, you see, and they didn't want it to be exposed as to how and why. That was an interesting little exercise. But we had a field day, and everyone could go up to Rockfield Road, if you know Auckland at all. That's in Penrose. That's where the milk station was. We went there, and we were able to see how everything was processed in different sections of the products that they were making. And one of the ones that caught my eye was the cottage cheese manufacturing. And as it was being processed, etc., and the stuff was showing off, there was a byproduct that was going to...
Sort of like whey.
It was a type of whey. And it was going down into the sewer. And couldn't work it out, so I approached the chemist, that had a chemist of the day, his name was Rickaby, to see what it was worth. And he came back and gave me a rundown of it. It was worth 3,000 food units a day. If I wanted it, it was there, and they would put up a silo, and then we would have to move it. But I had to get a piggery, and I was organising a piggery where we were going to set up with another guy. And it was then that the owners came back and wanted to sell the farm because they wanted to get on the ground floor and the thing there. And ultimately, I believe that product that I'd sussed out went to one of the major piggeries, Colville Piggeries in South Auckland. It was total waste. I don't know, they might extract it now. But that's what happened to the pig industry in the late 60s. Pig farming was hugely because of the whey byproduct. But then Fonterra were able to eventually extract pretty much everything out of it so that the end product that was left was just straight water.
Did they not use it like for irrigation? The whey, it's a liquid, instead of going down the drain, they could have been using it to irrigate, or no good for that?
No. I think some of the areas were doing that. When I went to Hallowey's, the whey was being pumped from the Pirata Dairy Company up over the hill down to the piggery, and I think we had something like 25,000 baconists in there. They had other piggeries as well. In the season when they couldn't cope, they had a huge dugout that was covered over with a polythene grounding, and they stored that for winter feed. Hallowey's had a wonderful system daily routine. It was very, very efficient. I was quite impressed with it.
So you were telling me initially that you and your wife went overseas to visit family and whatever. Did you have holidays or were you full-time on the farms?
No, we did have holidays away. When you say away, we went to the Bay of Islands twice when we were in Auckland. We took the girls and my niece in 1981 to Disneyland. They were able to work as a verb for us and we paid them well. And then when they went to cash their money in the exchange rate, we sat down from $1 to 80, they couldn't work that out. But that was wonderful. Then we came back and we bought a section in Hart Drive and that's when we built. And then we went over again in 94 on a tourist holiday. Then we went back in 2006 or 8 or whatever it was.
And you've been back to Niue?
Yes, we went to Niue about 2005.
So are there still family over it then?
Probably is, but we're not quite sure. All of them came to New Zealand. The 15 were all educated, except the young one. They spread their wings, you know. I mean, we kept in touch, and my brother keeps a genealogy of everybody and where they all are.
It would have been very interesting. Shall we finish this? You've done so many different things, and as I say, I'm amazed by your innovation and your ability to make changes and change careers from complete opposites.
I have to be honest though, when I went in for the piggery with the guy that I was partners with and I took my wife up the first time to meet him, she just did not take that. She didn't want me to be part of him.
Anyway, thank you very much for that.
No,
and we'll stop there.